In a scandal-ridden couple of weeks, one of the biggest scandals, if not necessarily the one getting the most press, has been the revelation that at least three of the men charged with preventing sexual assault in the military have themselves been arrested on sexual assault charges. I've been gratified to see people talking about how we need more than prosecutions, that the military culture needs to change. But what I have not seen much about is whether it's realistic to imagine that the military culture could change, given the mission of the military and the role it plays in our society. Someone who has written and spoken a great deal about the connections between militarism, gender roles, and sexual violence, both in our own context and internationally, is Cynthia Enloe. Professor Enloe is the author of many books, including Bananas, Beaches, and Bases, Making Feminist Sense of International Politics, Does Khaki Become You? The Militarization of Women's Lives, and Nemo's War, Emma's War, Making Feminist Sense of the Iraq War. She is currently research professor at Clark University, where she was previously director of women's studies for many years. She got her PhD in political science from Cal and told me that she remains a KPFA fan. Cynthia Enloe, thanks so much for joining me on Women's Magazine.
Kate, it's great to be here.
So Cynthia Enloe, I think it's safe to say that most people, including probably most feminists, were shocked by the arrest of Lieutenant Colonel Jeffrey Krasinski, the Air Force officer in charge of sexual abuse prevention, for grabbing a woman in a parking lot, and the accusation that a sergeant at Fort Hood, also in charge of a sexual assault prevention unit, is under investigation for assaulting at least three women and forcing one into prostitution. But probably we shouldn't have been as shocked as we were. What was your reaction to these revelations?
Well, it's a funny thing, Kate. I kind of hold on to the possibility of being shocked. In a sense, it's kind of hopeful. Not sanguine, but I'm always glad that I'm still shockable. Because I think if I'm totally unshockable, then I probably have listed over into cynicism, and cynicism doesn't make one very curious. As you suggested, I've spent a lot of time thinking about how military cultures become so deeply immersed in certain distorted ideas of masculinity. And as a result, you know, when these things happen, they do sound a bit as if they're a skit written for Saturday Night Live. But, of course, it should be outrageous even if the lieutenant and then the sergeant at Fort Hood, even if they'd been in charge of, say, what?
Auto maintenance.
Yes, auto maintenance. But it's not. It's all about who appointed them, who took them seriously, who just wanted the issue to go away and therefore didn't really choose people that they had vetted very carefully to make sure that, in fact, they were truly committed to rolling back misogyny and sexism inside their own institution. And probably the people who chose them are the ones we should really be curious about.
Well, I mean, let's talk some about that and about the role of misogyny and sexual violence in that institution, the U.S. military. Both President Obama and Secretary Chuck Hagel and many others have asserted that the military culture needs to change, and it certainly does. But do you think that it's possible that the military culture could change so that sexual violence wasn't as prevalent as it was inside the military without massive changes in the culture at large?
There are two bits to that, I guess, Kate. The first is that a very common defense that any institution, a police force, a state university, a military, one of the defenses that they put up is, oh, we are simply a mirror of society. Unless society changes, you can't expect us to change. And it's not as if it's totally untrue, but it's not a truth that the people who articulate it actually want to take any responsibility for. But the second thing it is that, particularly with the U.S. military, it is such a powerful cultural institution in shaping the whole of American society today. This wasn't true in the 1930s. It probably wasn't true so much in the 1880s, but by the 2000s, the U.S. military is so powerful as itself a shaper of American ideas about masculinity, about dignity, about women's rights, that it cannot claim that it's just a passive mirror. The second thing, I guess, is that when militaries now, military commanders and civilians in charge of them, or civilians in Congress, or civilians in the media, when they talk about the culture of an institution, they only go so far and will not talk about masculinity. And this is true in the gun control debate. All my feminist friends, and probably all of your feminist friends, every time they hear of a new atrocity committed by an American shooting using guns to kill their fellow citizens, all those feminists always say, when is anybody going to notice that they're all men? And when they notice that they're all men, when are they going to start talking about masculinity in American culture? So even if they did say, yes, it is, we have to change the American military's culture, they have to talk about masculinity. They have to talk about it, whether they're talking about Penn State or the BBC or any of the other institutions that have had recent sexualized scandals. But they won't go that far. There are a lot of people who know how to talk about masculinity, but they're not the people who are called in as experts.
You know, I was listening to an interview that you gave a few years back, actually quite some years back now, and I was surprised to hear you say that you didn't start out being interested in gender or looking at international politics through a gendered lens. So when and why did you first get interested in gender?
Well, when I did my PhD at Berkeley, which was in the 60s, where supposedly everything was up on the table for discussion and to be challenged. In fact, everything wasn't up on the table to be discussed. In the 1960s at University of California at Berkeley, during the free speech movement, there was no discussion of gender. There was no discussion of feminist ideas. The F word was never mentioned in not just any classes I took at Berkeley, but in any of the conversations I had with all my friends who were out on the picket lines, where I was as well. And there was no discussion of how peculiar the, at that time, University of California at Berkeley Political Science Department was. It was 50 tenure-track faculty in just political science, and out of 50 tenure-track faculty, there wasn't a single woman, and most of us didn't notice, including myself, and I went to a women's college where half the faculty in political science were women. But one of the things that I think did stand me in good stead is that when I was finally pushed by lots of friends of mine who were not academics to really start taking seriously this burgeoning discussion about feminist ideas, that when that time came, at least I had been looking at marginalized people, mainly in Southeast Asia, and how they experienced and were affected by the Vietnam War. So at least I knew that if you looked at the Vietnam War from the vantage point of the Hmong, the hill peoples in Indochina, that you would learn something about the Vietnam War you otherwise wouldn't know. And I think that kind of lesson of always take seriously the people who are pushed to the margins. If you listen to them carefully, in fact, you'll learn something about the alleged big picture that you'll otherwise miss. So that by the time, you know, again, I was pushed by other much smarter people to start asking feminist questions and to take seriously the workings of masculinity and femininity, at least I had that lesson already absorbed. And that really was a big help. But I didn't do... It's only now that I ask feminist questions about Berkeley in the 1960s. In fact, if somebody listening out there would like to do a feminist history of the free speech movement, go for it.
Wow, has nobody done that?
I don't think so. Yeah. To talk about the free speech movement, I think today one really has to talk about a certain kind of privileging of a certain kind of masculinity, even though so many very smart, thoughtful women took part in it.
Well, let me go back for a few minutes to the
sure. To
the question that we started with around the sexual abuse of women in the military. Can you talk some about the role that sexual violence plays in both militarization and the construction of masculinity?
Yeah, that's a big order, but I think
no, really?
Yeah, but a lot of militaries encourage a need. I would say not just encourage, they depend on a certain kind of masculinized attitude towards violence to be able to even build their forces, that is, in their recruitment, and to keep people motivated, especially men. So very, very few militaries, especially now in the early 2000s, will admit that. You can see it much more blatantly expressed in earlier generations where there wasn't women's movements to call them on it. Now it's a lot more camouflaged, but there is still, and I've talked to officers about this, male officers who are responsible for, quote, the morale of younger troops, that there still is this sense out there that not only that boys will be boys, that's one thing, that's kind of a passive, well, that's what young men do, and no military in the world can exist without relying on young men. Beyond that sense of boys will be boys, it's also that boys need to be boys. Now, that's something much harder for the institutions to admit, but you can get some senior male officers to admit it. They don't want to intervene in the uses of pornography around military bases or on ships or in field operations. The kind of casual but really quite damning uses of misogynist humor, all of that is not just something that is allowed to go on passively by the institution and by the senior people who are in charge of the institution. It's also this sense that, well, we need that, that if young men aren't able to have that sense of power, that sense of what senior men might call drive, that in fact you won't have the kind of morale that you need to be able to send the same young men to war. Now, there's a warning here, and that is, when I say young men, I don't mean that they're all the sole people to blame for this. It is older men. This is true in every institution I've looked at. It's older men's attempts to try and get younger men to do what the older men want done that is very much at the heart of this. And so while there's always a tendency of older commanders to portray the younger men as the problem, in fact, it is older men who have the power to create the culture. I don't know if you remember the tailhook scandal in September 1991. It didn't become a scandal until the revelations came out in 1992-93. But this is with Navy aircraft carrier pilots who are called tailhookers, because if you think of a plane landing on a deck and then having to catch that hook so they don't go overboard. And it was older squadron leaders who really encouraged these were all officers. They encouraged the younger officers to really create this profoundly abusive and misogynist squadron by squadron competition around the sexualization of women and men's power to control that sexualization.
And I think that, you know, you're seeing that now in some of the response to the what's come out recently. I was just watching Invisible War on PBS, and the Army spokeswoman, I think, that was being interviewed there, when they asked her, you know, who is committing these assaults, and she said, well, the average, or they're men 18 to 24. And if you look at, like, Colonel Krasinski for sure is not 18 to 24. And, you know, I'm not sure about some of these other men who have recently been arrested. But, I mean, the thing is that response clearly puts it as something, makes it seem to be something that, you know, young men just sort of newly in the military and lower ranks are doing. And in fact, it completely ignores the responsibility of, you know, that a lot of it is men in positions of a lot of power abusing that power that they have over younger women.
Yeah, I think when you see any institution where there's an abusive, masculinized culture that's been allowed to grow one should always ask feminist questions about the relationships between older men and younger men.
I think that we have to imagine, too, that some of what's happened within the military, the relationships between men and women in the military, have to do with the fact that women are seen as invading a historically masculine place. And really the place that more than any other institution in our society has given men their definition of what it means to be a real man and to be masculine.
Yeah. In fact, one of the most interesting innovations has been launched by a very small women's advocacy think tank in Washington called RI, Women's Research and Education Institute, RI. And they have a very small but very smart project within it called Women in Militaries Project, long time standing. Really, they testify before Congress. They keep data. They're really terrific. And the head of that is a woman named Lori Manning, and she's a former Navy captain. So she knows how the Pentagon works. And she, a couple of years ago, this is all thinking of what you were just saying. She, a couple of years ago, thought that when they have conferences on women in the military, and she brings women from various countries, from Australia and Britain and Canada, together with Americans, both researchers and members of militaries, to talk about what are the obstacles that women face in various militaries. But a couple of years ago, what she decided to do is to expand it and call it and make it Women in Uniformed Forces. Now, what was so interesting was that to hear women in fire departments talk, because fire departments in most countries, and certainly in the United States, until a whole bunch of court cases pried them open just barely, were intensely masculinized clubs and oftentimes racialized as well. But these women who broke into the ranks, if you will, of local fire departments talked about the abuse that they suffered for some of the same reasons you've just pointed out, that they were seen as invaders into prized masculinized spaces.
And, I mean, I don't know if you've looked at any militaries in which women have been more fully integrated, or even if such militaries really exist anywhere else in the world, but if the cultures are at all different in militaries in which women have been more fully integrated for a longer time.
Well, probably the most interesting work is done by women looking at the Scandinavian forces, particularly the Swedish and the Norwegian, which still, by the way, have male conscription. But both those forces, and I have a colleague in Sweden named Annick Kronsel, and she has just written a wonderful feminist analysis, a book, a feminist study of what's been happening to gender dynamics and gender politics inside the Swedish forces. And one of the things, though, that Annika found, and I think really does have an effect, and that is the military that you're trying to roll back a certain kind of distorted masculinist culture in, is it one that also has changed its world mission? And the fact that the Swedish forces, but there's something afoot, and I'll, before we get too hopeful here, but the Swedish forces have really institutionally taken very seriously their role as UN peacekeepers. They aren't in, Sweden is not in NATO, although there's a big push now to get Sweden to join NATO, and there's a right-center government in Sweden that seems quite friendly towards the idea of Sweden joining NATO. So all of this could change. But because Sweden, the Swedish government and the Swedish citizenry have felt pride in Sweden, the Swedish military's role in humanitarian aid and in UN peacekeeping, it seems to have lowered the intensity of a certain kind of aggressive masculinism inside the Swedish military, to the point that Swedish women may not confront as virulent a type of discrimination as they do in a lot of other force.
You mentioned earlier that our society, I think this is what you were saying, that our society is far more militarized now than it was at previous times in our history. Why do you feel like that is?
There are whole bunches of us, kind of a network around the U.S., and we actually work with people in other countries who are also alarmed at militarism in their own societies. One of my favorite doesn't mean I like it, just favorite means it makes me think, items in the kind of catalog of evidence of militarization is the uses of military flyovers to celebrate the openings of National Football League games, NFL League games. When you have a B-1 bomber fly over your football stadium, that has to be set up with many memos and many decisions and lots of coordination of a lot of institutions. So it's not just, oh, they were passing over when, you know, before the first kickoff. But what really alarms me, but I find really interesting, is how many people in the stadium, men and women, find it exciting, find it almost joyful, like it's part of the excitement of the new football season that a weapon of death is flying overhead. And that just makes me shudder, to tell you the truth. I'm here in Boston. I go to Red Sox games. I like the Red Sox a lot, and I love Fenway as a baseball park. But still, they feel they've got to pull out all the military-uniformed rituals now in a way that they didn't in the 1920s and 30s to start off a game. So what is militarized in your own local civilian rituals? And why is it that so many people find it enjoyable? I think it's something really to think about, but it does make it very hard to tackle sexism and sexual violence inside the military when the military itself has become such an object of national pride.
And sort of the expression of our national pride.
Yes, exactly. That,
like, if you are proud, then you are
pro-military. Then they are our heroes.
And I mean, and I really see it in people who are critical of the war and critical of the role that the military plays in many ways, but they are so effusive over individual soldiers who, like when Jon Stewart, for instance, and Stephen Colbert and Rachel Maddow, though, I mean, Rachel, I think, is a little extreme in that she comes from a military family and just has this really pro-military attitude in a lot of ways. But like Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert, generally speaking, they're, you know, aligned with anti-war politics. But when a soldier comes on their program, they're just so effusive in thank you for your service. And I, you know, I understand it. And it also feels to me like, you know, every time I hear that, it's reinforcing this idea that the way to be a good American is to go and kill some people overseas.
And nobody says that to somebody who works in a rape crisis center.
Exactly.
Nobody calls, you know, brings them on their popular network show and asks everyone in the audience to applaud for your national service.
Cynthia Enloe is the author of Bananas, Beaches, and Bases, Making Feminist Sense of International Politics, which I understand is being reworked as we speak for a new edition, and Nemo's War, Emma's War, Making Feminist Sense of the Iraq War, as well as many other publications. Thank you so much for this really lively and engaging conversation.
Thanks, Kate. I've enjoyed it.